Welcome back to another Awareness to Action Enneagram podcast. My name is Creek, and I'm with my unparalleled co-hosts, Lee Fields and Maria Jose Munita. I looked up what are unique words for perfect, and that's one of the words that came up. So Lee Fields is a friend of the pod. She's also one of the TAs at for the certification program that the ATA runs that we're wrapping up our second one, right?
Yes.
Well, second of the new version. I don't know how many you've done prior to this, but...
Lots, but this is kind of the second cycle of sessions, yes.
Okay, all right. Lee, real quick, for people, I know you've been on the pod a few times, but just give a real quick introduction as to who you are.
Sure. I think this is my first ATA pod experience.
Oh. No.
Okay.
You came on...
So many podcasts.
With me and... It was just me and Mario.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
On one of them.
It was my first Maria Jose podcast experience. That's why it feels so important.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm excited to have this conversation. Mario's out of the country, and so we had the opportunity to come hold space... for him and hear from Maria Jose.
So Maria Jose is a little uncomfortable because Lee and I decided we wanted to hear her backstory. How did she become the revolutionary figure she is? She is the Che Guevara of the Enneagram.
You know, it's funny because yesterday my brother, I have one brother only, and he sent me a WhatsApp kind of screenshot showing me that he was listening to a talk from a woman about the Enneagram at his company. Mm. And I was like, really? And he said, and I said to him, tell the people at HR that your sister, you know, it's the person. Yes. And he said, he showed me the message that he sent this person. And he said, she's the best in Chile at the Enneagram.
Hey.
And he said, I'm sure I'm not over kind of stating anything here. He said, you know, I think you're understating it. Yeah, it should be more than Chile, but anyway. part of me believes that, and part of me is uncomfortable with it. But
yeah.
I can deal with it.
Yeah. Of the five people I know that live in South America, you would be the best that I know.
Good. Good.
So let's start with. Yeah, where did you grow up? What was your family like?
I grew up in Chile, in Santiago. Santiago is the capital of Chile, and we say here that Santiago is Chile. So it's the main city, like 40%, I would say, or something like that, of the population lived here. And it's very kind of Santiago-centric. So I grew up here with my parents and my younger brother. He's 4 years younger than me. And it was a really, I don't know, average, normal childhood. I don't know, for me. And yeah, I've lived here for my whole life except for 2 years that I lived in South Africa. But that was when I was older. I was working and married. Already.
Yeah. And so you say Santiago is Chile. Most people live in Santiago because Chile is just really not that populated. It's kind of a wild place, correct? Like when it comes to like nature is what I'm saying. Not like
Yes. I'm not sure that wild, it's kind of not populated in many areas. It has it's really kind of long country, like 5,000 kilometers long. So we have a really dry desert in the north and the Patagonia in the south and Antarctica. Antarctica. So it is, very diverse geographically, mm-hmm. and yeah. There are many areas where there's not a lot of population. So there are big cities, but a lot of opportunities, work opportunities and things and services and are in Santiago.
One last question, then Lee, you can start talking. what's something that you grew up doing or an experience you had in Chile or just South America that you think would be wild for us North Americans to imagine doing on a regular basis? Hmm.
You didn't send that question before.
I didn't send that question.
Wild like, in South America? I don't know. Maybe the things we eat. We eat things from kind of seafood and things like that that might seem wild, probably. Mm. Like the sea urchin or there's something else. I don't remember how it's called in English. But yeah, maybe those things. You know? We're not that different. So some people okay. think that we kind of leap up the trees and things like that, but we don't. We have houses.
No,
no we don't.
Uh-huh. You have pet jaguars?
No. It's,
no? Okay.
Our lives seem pretty similar to what we see in the movies and what I've seen when I go to the States or Europe. So, yeah, it's not that wild.
I was really hoping for some sort of like you got lost in the jungle.
And, no, what came to mind is something that I did in South Africa, is that I rode an ostrich.
Is there video?
There isn't, yeah. But it was wild. It was wild. But it's not
that's
South America, it's South Africa. Yeah. There's one picture, though, with my face, and I listeners will not be able to see that, but it's like, like really kind of freaking out because it was a really wild experience. It was cool.
Well, if you can send me that picture, we can figure out how to get it on the interwebs
I'll look for it. I'll look for it.
Yeah, okay. All right.
I'm not sure I believe that.
That I'll look for it? I will.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, changing the subject perhaps entirely, or maybe this was the genesis of where your exploration of personal growth work came in, this ostrich experience. But have you always been interested in personal growth or development work? How did that come into your arena?
When I was a teenager, my parents started doing personal work, both of them, for different reasons, together and on their own. And we were kind of exposed to that. My parents went to some talks from a woman that I later on studied with, and they recorded the sessions in cassettes. And when we were in the car, we would listen to it. It was so boring, but I was exposed to those things. But also my dad went to a Dale Carnegie workshop.
Oh, wow.
You know, how to make friends and whatever. And these people created a workshop for teenagers because adults said all the time that if they had learned about these things or had these tools from a younger age, their lives would be different. So they did something for teenagers. I was about around 13, I would say, and I went to that workshop. It was life-changing. I was not that shy, but more. And so I developed certain tools. And then they chose a few of us to help for the following courses. And of course, I was chosen. So I participated in like two or three more of those workshops with other kids. So that's my first experience with self-development.
What did that experience teach you? Like, what's the main thing that you think really impacted you in that course?
I think that there are some things about losing, kind of not being embarrassed of talking in public. That's the thing that I remember the most. But also, I think that the example of my parents doing self-development at that age, when they were grown-ups, adults, old people in my head, being willing to do it and being able to change, I think was the most impactful thing. It's like, if they can change, anybody can. Don't come to me with saying that you're the way you are and will not be able to change.
Would you still identify yourself as a shy person?
No. No. I think I'm reserved when I'm not that comfortable in a particular environment, but not shy.
So you said you have one brother. Do you have other siblings also?
No.
No. So was he in the car listening to the cassettes also?
I don't remember.
Okay.
You know, it's funny because I was 4 years older. My grandmother used to live with us, not live with us, but came home every day. So I spent a lot of time with her. I was her favorite, I don't know, grandchild. And she used to tell me, wouldn't you wish that you were a single child, you know, that you didn't have brothers? and because there was such an age gap, I grew up, we both grew up, I think, like if we were the only child. A bit, in a way. So, yeah, I don't remember. He probably was sleeping.
Okay. But, sleeping. Yeah. I wondered if you had a peer to have conversations with about your seeing your parents do this sort of work, like you're witnessing that and seeing how they're changing or exploring. I have not had that experience.
No,
I do not
either.
Have parents that are...
Yeah, no, I didn't. I think it was about around the time when I started studying at university that I met more people like were interested in these things. And for me, my parents were kind of reference in that regard. And I used to use them as kind of an example of you can do that.
So you talked about that course that you did. And we all have different points in our lives that are kind of pivotal moments that really kind of define a before and after. Like for me, one of mine is when I did 3 months in China. That was a huge shifting point for me. So what are like three moments like that? And what did those moments teach you?
So the moments that I can think of, and maybe there are more that are not coming to mind. One is when I lived in South Africa. It is such a different culture from where I come from. And it's so diverse. It's, when you talk about diversity, it's usually very limited. At least here, it was very limited. And now it's a lot more diverse. But at the time when I was there, it was like 23 years ago. Wow. Yes. The diversity was around religion, race, and all sorts of things. So, yeah, that changed my perspective. Things around it showed me how countries from the south, like Chile and South Africa, are always looking north and not sideways. And I don't know, I learned a lot about how we move, what our reference are, and things like that, but also how to respect diversity or how to interact and engage with people from other religions, for example. I had to work with people who were very, very different from me. People who had been discriminated for a long time. And I also learned about affirmative action, how this discrimination had to be counterbalanced, like forcing it. If not, it would not happen. That experience for me has been very impactful. So that was one.
In what way? Like as in just kind of understanding...
Yeah,
so
as a woman, I feel like a very empowered woman. I have no issues with owning my place and doing whatever I want to do and not feel limited because I'm a woman. However, I do think that it is important to have some gender quotas and things like that. I do think that men have, in history, had... used or occupied a space that it will not change fast enough if women are not forced a bit into some roles in companies and things like that. And if you do that, the system will accommodate, will education will change, and how you, I don't know, split the tasks at home will change. All the things will adjust, but you need to do something to force it. And some people in my world feel almost humiliated because women need to be forced to be in certain roles and things like that. I do see it as a phenomena that needs to be pushed in order to happen fast or faster. Had I not lived in South Africa and seen how non-white people had been discriminated and how they were forcing back all the costs that it had. But even though there were costs, it was the only solution. I probably wouldn't think this way today.
Yeah, thanks for that. What's another one?
When I became a mother.
Mm.
Yeah, well, life
that
changes.
Old thing.
Yeah, well, that little thing. Yeah. But you just cannot send them back, you know? And it's not a hobby. It's a job that you do willingly. You love it, and it's tiring. And you wish you didn't have it to have to do it every day, but you do. And you love them as you never thought you would love someone. I think it's just hard to explain, but that was life-changing. People depend on you in a way that you just cannot run away from.
I feel that when you say it. It's like 24 hours on call, no days off.
Yeah.
The perpetual ongoing nature of parenting. I seriously underestimated myself. I'm like, oh,
yes.
It's wonderful. And
like, what surprised you about being a mother?
Everything. Yeah, you know, I think that human nature, I mean, we're wired to have children. If we were not, we wouldn't have it. When you do the maths, it doesn't add up. It's just an impulse. And you follow that impulse, and you have the children, and then you realize what you're getting into. And that's how it works. And
I think right now I'm too aware of what I'd be getting into if I had kids. I have too many.
But it's wonderful. It's wonderful.
Yeah, that's what I hear.
I wouldn't change it. I would do it all over again. But I'm learning so that it becomes easier.
Yeah, that perspective is something, right?
Yes. <Yeah. laughs> So the third thing that I thought about is when I started understanding how the brain works. And it could be seen as, oh, I'm saying this because I'm in this podcast and it's the Awareness to Action podcast, but I'm not. It's seeing how I tend to fool myself and how I don't see clearly when I thought that I was the most logical, objective person in the world, almost. That was quite a shift in perspective.
Painful.
Yeah, but also liberating and exciting, you know? So like the curiosity sparked kind of up something in me that makes life more interesting. And a lot of things have changed since I started this journey.
Yeah. Like ATA journey or life journey?
Well, how can you split? I mean, how can you discriminate between those two things?
Sure.
It began when I, around the time when I started studying with Mario. So yes, around that time, not only because of him, but around that time, like a year earlier, with my husband, who started getting interested in those things. So when I started working with Mario or studying with Mario, he started mentioning some books. They were all at home because my husband had already started talking and learning about those things. And yeah, so that's why one of the reasons why the ATA approach started making sense to me, because it was a mindset. It's not just Enneagram theory. It's a mindset that I really resonate with and like.
Do your kids know the Enneagram?
They do. I don't talk about it much at home. But they do see that I do a lot of Enneagram things. And with social media, they see me in social media. And so it's hard to hide it. But I talked to my oldest daughter about the Enneagram not so long ago. Recently, I did a workshop for her and friends of her. But I tried not to influence her when she was younger. I used it with her to understand her worldview and how to deal with her more effectively, but didn't talk about it with her. With the other one, I've talked to her. She's really eager to know more, but I try to avoid it.
What's your hesitation?
I don't want her to see herself through that lens so soon. I want her to be aware of herself, her reactions freely. I think that there's a temptation, a natural temptation, to explain yourself through, I mean, using the Enneagram. And I think it's too soon for that.
If you don't know yourself first.
Yes.
Right.
That makes sense. Yeah.
Reflecting on yourself, what is something that your past self would be surprised about your current self?
Not only my past self, but people around me today might be surprised as well. I think that, so I hate to talk about my type, but it might help.
You can talk about your essence if you want.
No.
So, Creek, we made it all the way to here.
No,
so close.
Well, I'll leave my type for later, but I think that being able to embrace things that I used to reject about myself earlier is something that my past self would be surprised. Like, how come that now you do these things or embrace these things that you used to reject or hide before? And that I really like about myself, but also I think that probably made me suffer more in the past and now, or not be as, feel as fulfilled or happy to before.
You sort of touched on, or what I'm hearing is something around satisfaction, right? That there's more freedom or ease or satisfaction with your present and presumably future self than your past self. Do you attribute that in part, or how do you attribute that to the inner work that you've done or your awareness around not just your type, but your experience in the world, your awareness of accessibility to counterintuitive places or whatever?
That's a big question. I think that there's so many things there that it's hard to unpack. But one of these things is what I just said about kind of being able to observe my contradictions and not try to eliminate one side, but accept both and decide what I want to do about it. I also think that by doing that and understanding human nature better, I can accept other people more, be more empathic and less judgmental, which allows me to connect to people better, in a deeper way. So those would be two things. Okay. But there's a lot more. And yeah, I'm not even there. So... more to come.
But yes, but I'm hearing a lot of baked in Enneagram there, actually, awareness and learning. How did you come to the Enneagram?
Through my parents, these Spanish woman who used to talk and they recorded. One of the things that she taught was the Enneagram. So I went to a workshop with them when I was like 18. And I answered, kind of, I took a test and I came up as a 7. No wonder why I didn't keep on working with it, because it didn't, probably didn't resonate with me that much. And later on, when I got married, my husband and I went to another workshop with the same woman. And it made sense to us. Now, he bought all the books. And he's a 5, by the way. And I wanted more of the experience of it. So I thought, okay, so she studied the Enneagram at the Enneagram Institute. So what do I want to do? And I started going to the Enneagram Institute. That was 2008. Yes. I started going there and took all of their trainings.
So you studied at the Enneagram Institute mm-hmm. under who and for how long?
I went there like 3 or 4 times a year for 2 years when Don was sick, but then he returned. So I studied with Don, Russ, Gil Scott, and Andrea Isaacs for one of the trainings. So I did retreats and all of the training and the masterclass and things like that.
And were you doing coaching at that time, or was this prior to coaching?
So the first year when I started going, I had a part-time job. I was working full-time, and I told my employer, you know what, I want to study the Enneagram. I want to study coaching. So I was studying coaching at the same time, and I want to work part-time so that I can do all of that. And they let me do that. But halfway through the year, I decided that I wanted to do this full-time. So at the end of that year, I started coaching and teaching the Enneagram.
And how, you said you were studying coaching. Was that under a particular brand or what?
Yes. So in Chile and South America, I would say it's very popular, a branch of coaching that it's called ontological coaching. And they have... Yeah, I know.
Yikes.
That word.
That's a word.
I know. But it's no way to do it than saying it. So there are a few schools, a couple of schools that teach it. I mean, a few, but the main two, mm-hmm. I studied with one of the main two. They're in the States and they're here in Spain and all of South America. So, yeah. Mm. But... I have to say that I studied coaching at the very same time that I studied the Enneagram. So my coaching style has always been kind of going together with the Enneagram. So it's hard for me to separate between those two because, I mean, I know there are some tools and some things that I take from each side, but I've never been... like the typical ontological coach because of my influence of with the Enneagram and the influence from Mario.
Yeah.
And there it is.
There it is. There's the first utterance of...
We got ontological and Mario in like 2 minutes.
Maybe you can edit it, Creek, and put out beep while I'm saying it.
This is what happens when he leaves the country.
Yes.
Okay, let's stop talking about him.
Okay.
Well, so you continued working with the IEA or with the Institute and kind of teaching that alongside the coaching.
Yes. That was 2008. 2009, okay. I became part of the IEA board.
And that's where you met...
Yes, a lot of
the
people.
The man, the myth.
A lot of people.
A lot of people.
I met a lot of people. So I was...
A specific person as well.
So I was studying at the Enneagram Institute, and then I also took a training with Ginger because I wanted more tools for kind of working in corporate settings. And at the same time, I went to my first IEA conference. And when I was... When I thought that I was almost done with my training, I realized that there was so much more than just the Enneagram Institute point of view. So I was almost desperate, like seeing all these things that I wanted to know more about. And when I became part of the board, it was interesting to just learn more about other approaches and things like that. So my time in the IEA, I was there for 6 years, was a really nice way to get acquainted with teachers from all schools and approaches and perspectives that I wasn't familiar with.
Prior to the ATA experience that you have, what was working or not working from the other schools that you learned from?
I think most things were working. I think that as long as the approach is not too bad, and I'm not saying this is too bad, you learn from kind of reflecting around kind of yourself becoming more aware. And it was all working, I would say. And the experience, the exercises, the people, the conversations, all of that contributed to my inner growth. So now when teaching, there was a different story, because in some topics, whatever Ross said that sounded so beautiful coming out of his mouth, whenever I tried to say it, it didn't make that much sense to me. And it might be that I wasn't that competent in the topic, but also, I don't know, it was different coming out of my mouth. So that wasn't working that well.
Is that a point where you were just like, there's got to be another way of going about this? Or what made you continue to push into?
I think that I was fine until I met Mario.
That's
and then everything
story.
Changed.
Yeah. He spoiled it for me. No, I was in one of these trainings or a retreat in Connecticut, I think. And I was there with friends that had all been taking all the trainings. And one of them said to me, you know, I met this guy who does kind of corporate work with the Enneagram, and he has these weird ideas about the instincts. I said, interesting. But I didn't pay much attention. And at the first in-person Enneagram IA meeting, I met Mario and I said, are you the guy who has these ideas about the instincts? And, oh, I've heard about you, blah, blah, blah. And we started talking. And I'm not sure how much we talked, but he was fine and he was friendly and we got along well. So we started interacting. And then I said, well, your program sounds interesting. Now, the problem is that I've been coming here for 2 years, several times a year, and I just can't afford to keep on coming. So he started training me via Skype. And yeah, that's old. And yeah. That was 2010. So he started teaching me around that time about the Enneagram, his approach, his mindset, critical thinking, and all of those things. And I could hear how my brain started to kind of crack, you know, like but not so much because of the Enneagram conversations, but I think more about the brain, how the brain works and critical thinking and all of that. That changed my perspective a lot. And my business partner at the time was on the same track, and my husband at home as well. I said, you know, I'm surrounded by these people who think this way. Maybe there's something that I need to look at. And I did.
How long did it take for you to like be studying with Mario before you felt like you were grasping what he was trying to do underneath it all?
I don't remember. Okay. All I know is that this started like in February of 2010. And in June, he did a training with Bob Talon, his co-author, in Denver, and I decided that I had to go. So I was probably pretty convinced by that then. And it was in October that we did a meeting. We organized together a meeting in Miami with people who had been studying with him from around the world, and I decided to collaborate with him then. So it didn't take long. And I remember that I started teaching kind of combination of what I knew from before and his approach. But pretty soon, I started just teaching his approach.
Mm-hmm. What was that process like?
I had slides that had both approaches, and then I deleted the slides that had the other approach. I realized that I didn't need the rest, that it was more confusing than helpful. Now, it doesn't mean that I don't take into account what I've learned from other sources, you know, but the interface, the what I show, where I start, the terminology that I used, it's the awareness to actions kind of approach. But it's hard to say that I only talk about the things that I've learned, the awareness to action approach, because I have life experiences, I have my own observations, I have other teachings. So it's hard to say, but the interface, it's awareness to actions.
Would you say that is, when you say the interface, it's like that's how you teach the Enneagram, and the rest is you bring to the table your own experience, your own awareness, your own teachings from other models or whatever to apply and address that. But the scaffolding or framework of how Enneagram works, you stick with the ATA model.
I would say that this interface of the kind of the shell of it, it's awareness to actions. But what's inside, it's very much informed by this approach as well. There are other things as well, other teachings, and a lot of my experience. I mean, every time I'm talking about something or observing something, I'm learning more, and the approach makes more sense, or it's more kind of deeply rooted in me. So it's an organic growth of the knowledge, I would say, that it doesn't stop. It does have some things that come from other approaches, but I would say that I've trimmed that heavily and I've stayed with mainly the awareness to action approach.
I'd love to go back to the moment of brain cracking, as you said. So can you outline what that experience was like for you, and talk about that struggle? And I know you originally said it is both painful and exciting, but I know for a lot of people that brain cracking is terrifying. So could you just kind of talk about that experience for you, and what were some helpful things that you did to continue forward and learn from it instead of let it paralyze you?
Yeah, so it was terrifying. It felt to me at the time as if I were throwing myself into a really deep thing, looking backwards and like not knowing what was going to happen. Because you need to let go of so many certainties that you think you have. It's the beliefs that I have about, I don't know, from where, why things happen, and how to explain things, and I don't know, so much, because it kind of shakes a lot of these certainties. But the way in which I approached it, which helped me, and it took like a couple of years, I have to say, to go through that, was to take it as a hypothesis. So I said, okay, I'll not pretend, but I'll live as if these ideas were true and try to stick to them and see what happens. Mm-hmm. I can always let that go and go back to my default beliefs, but this is my hypothesis. So when I catched myself in the act, like going back to my previous beliefs, I said, no, you need to be consistent. If you believe this, then you have to do that. So I kept going, but knowing that I could always go back, because this was just a hypothesis that I was testing, until it made sense, until I went through that kind of darkness or whatever you want to call it, and realized that instead of feeling less kind of, I'm not sure what the word is, because it's lonely or not held, or kind of that this uncertainty would kill me, or not kill me, but in a figurative way. Or
like you felt isolated.
Isolated.
Yeah, it's isolated, but the isolation, it's more like there's this contention that I wouldn't feel, because there were no certainties in so many aspects. And when I went through that, I didn't need it anymore, you know? And without thinking that it was all up to me. mm-hmm. but without needing it. So I don't need these certainties anymore. And I'm okay with it. And I feel free. And I feel like I can embrace and enjoy more things than I used to. And I wish I had certain certainties now, but, you know, it's part of the package.
Right. Disappointing truths, right?
Yes.
Like, ah, gift with purchase.
That's really beautiful and brave at the same time. I think that's our impulse is always to run from the contradictions and uncertainties. And I think it's those who are voraciously curious that their curiosity gets the better of them to press to like, I think I can manage this a bit longer and then a bit longer. Then all of a sudden you're like, oh yeah, this other side isn't so bad.
Yeah.
I'm doing it.
Yeah. Look, mom, no hands. Like I'm riding my bike. Yeah. So what did that process teach you that you want to pass on to your children?
Well, I'm teaching them critical thinking more than the Enneagram. Mm. I'm teaching them how to think. That's the main thing for me. I have cards with logical fallacies and cognitive biases, and sometimes I'm very nerdly play with them with them. And whenever they come up with a belief that can be challenged, I do it in a loving way. But I think that if I can leave them something, it's that information they have in their phone. I can leave them a phone as well, but learn teaching
charging
them,
cord.
Yeah, how to think to me is the most important thing.
Mm-hmm. Do you have time for one quick last question?
One, yes.
Looking over what you've learned and who you've become, what are you most proud of about yourself?
One thing.
I'd like three, but you said real quick, so.
Okay, but I have three, so.
Okay,
okay, good.
Give us three.
then I'll take three. Absolutely.
One is my ability to be flexible, and not only kind of be able to change my mind, but also grow, change my behavior, be more adaptive. Mm-hmm. And when people say, "But you didn't used to do that," you were different before. I said, yeah, and I'm really proud of it, you know.
Yeah.
I can change my mind. And that I really like. Before, I used to be more attached to my ideas, and now I feel lighter in that way.
Mm. Mm.
The other thing
That's inspiring. That's inspiring, MJ.
My understanding of human nature and what we've been talking about around contradictions and embracing those things, that makes me be more accepting of myself and others. That in the work that I do as a coach or Enneagram trainer is very helpful. I can see how people feel good with that. And the third thing is the most important one, and I'm really proud of that, is that my children feel safe telling me everything.
Hmm.
And that behind that, there are a lot of things. And
yeah.
It's been working towards that, challenging myself. And when they come to me to tell me about the things that they're struggling with, it's a gift.
Well, it's been a gift to talk to you today, MJ. Thank you so much.
Well, we'll see how many people listen to this. But
yeah. Well, I think you're a bigger deal than you think you are.
No, look, it was really
in
nice.
In North America.
I really enjoyed this episode.
Yes.
And we should try to do another one without him.
I think so too. Just him.
Okay.
But yeah, thank you. And those who are listening, if you have any other questions that may have come up about MJ's Oreo story, origin story, or just any other questions, please make sure to shoot them over and maybe we can do a we can do a follow-up interview with all your questions. So
thank you so much.
You. We'll talk to you next week.
Talk to you. Bye.
Thanks for listening to the Awareness to Action Enneagram podcast. If you're interested in more information or talking to Mario, MJ, or myself, feel free to reach out to us through the links in the show notes or by emailing info@awarenesstoaction.com. All episode transcriptions and further information can be found at awarenesstoaction.com/podcast.